Hello, this is Gavin Jackson. Welcome to a special edition of the South Carolina Lead from Washington. We're taping this episode 2 days after President Donald Trump was impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives. South Carolina's five Republican congressmen voted against the two articles of impeachment. The two Democrats supported the abuse of power and obstruction of Congress articles. The charges stem from the president withholding critical military aid from Ukraine and a meeting with its president in exchange for an investigation and information against Trump's political opponent, Joe Biden. It was a historic day, and that's why I'm in town, as is Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Emma Dumain with McClatchy, D.C. Welcome to you both. Emma, welcome to your first lead taping. Here we are in Tune In, a bar that you recommended for us, and it is a lively Washington bar scene.
It is a lively Washington bar scene, indeed. It is a D.C. institution. This is a real Capitol Hill dive.
Okay.
So I really, when we were talking about where we could record this podcast, I thought this would be a very, would be a good scene, mm-hmm. would really give you a flavor of the community.
Yeah. That's why we go to the Capitol Expert, to know where to drink.
Yes.
That's why.
And you can hear the great music in the background, the people. You can even hear my Guinness clinking against the microphone.
Very atmospheric.
And of course, Mayon Schechter is here. She's up visiting.
Hey, Mayon.
Hey, Mayon. Feel free to jump in at any time.
Hey.
So yeah, a lot of history this week, a big week. Jamie, I want to start with you. Last time we talked, if you remember this, I know it was a month ago, but it seems like a year ago. Last time we talked, impeachment was in early November. The House just formalized its inquiry. You just returned from D.C. The Nats just won the World Series.
Oh, boy. I'll never forget it.
And now it's just days before Christmas. Donald Trump has become the third president impeached in the nation's history. And I just want to kind of get your perspective of this past week. You broke the story about Joe Cunningham, Representative Joe Cunningham from the 1st Congressional District, making his decision on how to vote on impeachment. That was earlier in the week. And the music in the background. And it's interesting to look because he's one of those at-risk Democrats. And it was a big deal. There's a lot of focus in South Carolina on how he was going to vote, as well as nationwide. So tell me about that story and how Joe Cunningham fit into this historic week.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, what was fascinating is at the end of the day, almost no Democrats ended up, splitting with the party on this. Colin Peterson, a veteran in a conservative district, voted against impeachment. And then Jeff Van Drew, who ended up switching parties to become a Republican, a freshman Democrat, voted against it. Other than that, every single one of the freshman Democrats who are all, you know, the 29 of them who are from districts that Trump won in 2016, all voted for this. So he was not actually, you know, outside of the mainstream in that sense. He concluded on Monday that after reviewing all of this, that he viewed it as an abuse of power and that Trump had not cooperated with congressional investigations into this. And, you know, basically said that he understood that this was a political risk. He understood that there were folks in his district who were not going to agree with him. But he felt like he had an obligation to uphold the oath that he swore.
And a lot of Republicans were coming against him saying, oh, he's putting politics above the low country, above with this impeachment discussion. But he said, no, that's not exactly true, because if I wanted to play politics, I would have said no against impeachment, because my constituents were even willing to forgive me. I mean, I talked to people this past weekend. They were saying, well, if he votes against him, like, that's fine. We'll still reelect him. But I think this vote actually, I guess, energizes his Democratic base.
Yeah.
But gives his Republican opponents obviously more firepower when it comes to reelection.
There's definitely an argument to be had that the politically easier move would have been to vote against it, basically with the thinking being that all the Democrats will support you anyway, and you're not going to lose any moderates or Republicans who might have voted for you until you vote for impeachment. You know, the question there still would be, are you going to de-energize Democrats in your district? And I think particularly, and I mentioned again, all the freshmen ended up voting for this. If you had not voted for this, you would have been a standout. You would have made national news. You would have been the only one. And that's a precarious situation to be in as well. So, you know, I think it ended up coming down that way.
Emma, jump in on this and tell me a little bit about your perspective as you cover the leadership in Congress.
Yeah, so first of all, I think that Jamie makes a really good point that what would it have meant if Joe Cunningham had been an outlier, as opposed to someone who played with the team, which, you know, brings me to another point that I think is worth making, is Democratic leadership didn't whip this vote. Another South Carolina lawmaker, the other Democrat in the congressional delegation, Jim Clyburn, is the whip that position refers to, you know, sort of figurative arm twisting, trying to get lawmakers to vote with the party, to stay with the team. Clyburn was treating this as a conscious vote. He was not asking members to vote a certain way. At the same time, leadership was making it very clear how they wanted members to vote. It was rapidly becoming an inhospitable environment for a Democrat in the House to say, I don't think we should impeach this guy. It would not have been popular. I'm sure people aren't pleased with Colin Peterson, even though they come to expect that of him. You know, I'm sure they were not pleased with Congressman Golden from Maine, who split his votes. I believe that he voted for one article of impeachment and not another. Democratic leadership made it clear they wanted unity on this. And I think that there was an unspoken level of pressure on members. And I also think that from a unity perspective, it became safer for someone like Joe Cunningham to vote with the team because so many of his colleagues were. I think that if you had seen more vulnerable freshman Democrats split from the party, Cunningham could have felt more comfortable going with them. It's safety in numbers.
I want to jump in on that and just say I was talking to Congressman Clyburn that day during the proceedings on the floor, and he said, you know, I asked him, like, you know, how is this vote going to look when we look 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we look at history? And he said, you know, some people may suffer from this vote. You know, we're talking about those at-risk freshmen, but 5 to 10 years later from now, they're going to realize that that was the correct vote to do. So I'm guessing even if Joe Cunningham, you know, faces a chopping block in 2020, Jamie, that at least he can say that he did what he thought was right.
You know, I mean, this is a lot of these freshman Democrats all used a lot of similar language when they were talking about this. They said, you know, look, if I lose my seat, I'll obviously be disappointed, but I have to look myself in the mirror and I have to feel comfortable with my conscience on this. And, you know, I'm not going to take this move because of politics, you know, and Joe Cunningham has given himself a little bit of room in terms of the fact that he has voted against other Democratic priorities, and he's able to tout that to be able to say that he is not just a party line guy, voted against raising the minimum wage, obviously voted against Pelosi as Speaker, which he said he would do on the campaign trail. The question is going to be whether or not any of that can actually break through with the electorate in November, or whether, as the Republicans are, I'm sure, going to try to do, make it all about impeachment and that decision and make that override all the other work that he has done.
Did you have anything to add on that with there, Emma, or no?
Jamie sums it up beautifully.
kind of talking, sticking with Clyburn, him and some other members, and you probably know more about this because you do cover the leadership, wanted more articles of impeachment to go forward, but they only got with those two. What was the strategy behind that, Emma, and why they stuck with just those two articles, and especially in the perspective of these at-risk lawmakers and how that would have affected them if they had the, you know, a whole slate of issues more than these two?
Yeah, this was the subject to a lot of intense debate and discussion. The feeling among the top members of Democratic leadership in the House, particularly Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who has become a household name and, you know, one of the new, you know, villains among Republicans in this process. Their perspective was the Ukraine controversy, the allegations that Trump dangled the possibility that he wouldn't be giving military assistance to Ukraine in exchange for investigating Joe and Hunter Biden. That was the breaking point for a lot of Democrats. That was the point at which Democrats in larger numbers said, you know, impeachment is, you know, our only recourse right now. And it wasn't the Mueller report, which was about obstruction of justice and the Russian investigation in the Department of Justice. This was the calculation was that if Democrats weren't willing to support impeachment in the Mueller report, why would you use that as one of these, you know, why would that galvanize people now? Right. And if you didn't think that the Mueller report had enough evidence to impeach, why would you bring that onto the floor as an article of impeachment? Stick with what was the galvanizing force among Democrats at that moment in time.
Jamie, kind of sticking with the Mueller report a little bit, we did hear from Senator Lindsey Graham, who had an impromptu press conference outside of his office. He did say, you know, I kind of gave them the chance during the Mueller report. I even pushed for legislation to protect Mueller.
Yeah.
And he was just saying, he said it was a monumental day. So he's kind of walking two lines there. He's saying, we tried with the Mueller report, nothing came of it. So now here we are making this sham impeachment trial. But he said the impeachment process was becoming weaponized. And I talked with some other lawmakers, and it seems pretty split between who you ask. If a Democrat, they're saying, no, this is just us doing our job. Republicans say this is going to become more of an issue going forward. I just want to know, what have you been hearing about that from Lindsey Graham's perspective, and what role he's been playing in this impeachment process? Because it's now going to the Senate, but he's also been pretty much quarterback in this from the Senate.
Been a commentator on the side for this. He had a very interesting press conference on the day of the vote, talking about impeachment being weaponized. I think he said, Lindsey Graham is someone who has never been afraid to, in some ways, kind of critique elements of his own party. And he kind of said, there are crazy folks among Republicans just as there are crazy folks among Democrats. And if you guys start doing this, then don't be surprised when they do it to a Democratic president. He was even saying, I'm going to do it. He was just saying there are going to be, Steve King can go ahead and, impeach the next Democratic president. And so, that was, and that's not a concern that is only held by Lindsey Graham. And even I think some Democrats have, that's been one of the uneasy elements of this for some of them has been, we don't want to make this a regular question that hangs over every president for every action they take. And it is it's the most dramatic course of action you can take against anybody. It is the political death penalty to remove them from office. With impeachment, you actually cannot run for any other federal office once you're removed from the presidency. So, he certainly has been a colorful commentator throughout the House process. When it comes to the Senate, he has been very clear for a long time that he wants it to end very quickly. He has pushed back against the White House, which had sort of indicated for a while they kind of wanted to use the Senate trial to mount a defense of Trump and have some witnesses that weren't able to go to the House side come to the Senate side. Seems now like the White House is maybe agreeing with him a little more, and Mitch McConnell seems to be getting closer to that to say, let's just get this out of the way. So he is, as obviously chairman of judiciary, he's going to play a valuable role. If we'll get to this in a second, if it even gets over to the Senate.
We're still waiting for that. Emma, just want to jump in on and kind of give us a little status update now that they have voted on those impeachment articles. Where they are, because it seems like we're in a little bit of a limbo situation here.
Yeah, so Nancy Pelosi threw a real curveball, to say the least, on Wednesday night. I've actually never quite seen anything like that.
Anything like much of this.
To be fair. Pelosi Wednesday night, Wednesday throughout the day, there'd been these rumors, sort of bubbling beneath the surface that, maybe Pelosi was going to withhold the transmission of the articles of impeachment to the Senate to try to force Mitch McConnell and the White House to agree to some, quote unquote, fair parameters. Basically, McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been going on TV and going to press conferences saying, I'm not an impartial juror. This is political. I'm going to coordinate this entire process with the White House and their attorneys, and Democrats have kind of lost it. And, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York is saying, we only want to agree to a trial that would have witnesses, that would have documents. South Carolina's own Mick Mulvaney, acting White House Chief of Staff, they want him to testify. They want former National Security Advisor John Bolton. So what Pelosi said on Wednesday night after they had voted on articles of impeachment was, we want to wait for a fair trial. We don't know what the Senate's going to come up with. So, we're not going to let them start a trial until we know what the ground rules are. In the meantime, McConnell, is not agreeing to Schumer's demands for a predetermined list of witnesses and documents. Schumer is standing his ground in coordination with Pelosi. Graham went to the cameras at the White House, I believe, last night and said, I just spoke to the president and he's mad as hell and wants his day in court. So, I think another thing that we've seen, at least in my reporting, my sense is that Trump has been the one who has been hammering for witnesses, for a spectacle, for a real dramatic show. and that the people around him in his corner, including Mitch McConnell, have been suggesting that that might not actually be in the president's best interest. So I think when you see the White House kind of push, you know, sort of tamping down the demands for witnesses, that's less Trump and more his people kind of trying to set expectations for what they can reasonably expect in these proceedings.
So January is going to be still like wait and see at this point. I mean, it's still like we're like a little standoff here right
now.
I mean,
I think an expectation at one point would have been that Pelosi would have sent over the articles by now. They have left for the holiday without having done that. So there's no guarantee right now about when the stalemate could end.
And Jim Clyburn said yesterday on CNN he'd be perfectly fine with them holding on to it forever, like never passing it over, never sending it
over
to the Senate.
They said it was unconstitutional because of your...
Well, there's questions about that, but it's very vague.
Because we're in this very gray area of the Constitution right now.
But very little precedent for this.
But also, as we know, covering South Carolina, Jim Clyburn often goes off script.
I do not think that that was...
I don't think Nancy Pelosi didn't clear that one. But it does. But it does speak to the disagreement within the House Democratic Caucus about what the best strategy should be.
He's definitely in a lot of these meetings where they're talking about
this.
So this is not necessarily coming out of nowhere.
No.
Which is another reason why, you know, people are saying, "No, why are you guys talking about impeachment?" The South Carolina lead. Well, baby, guess what? We got a lot of people up here doing stuff when it comes to the impeachment.
That's right.
Emma, it's kind of just still keeping with the week, and you know, you're here every day. You're covering Congress. We buzz up here, and every now and then.
I want to ask only for the fun parts.
Right.
And for the record, I have family up in the area, and I think my brother is actually walking into the bar right now. So I'm up here early for Christmas, and there just so happened to be an impeachment trial that I adhere and vote. But Emma, I want to ask you about the week, because you cover it every day, like I said. And, you know, tell me about the scene that was inside the chamber, because it was interesting, because this week has been bookended by bipartisanship, too. Mm-hmm. We have the spending bill, and then you have the impeachment vote, and then you have USMCA passing. And I just want to ask you, you know, we're talking about weird things happening. How do you even rank this week? I mean, it's what you've seen.
You know, the weirdest moment for me in all of this was actually last week when Pelosi and her leadership team held a press conference at 9 a.m. announcing the articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. And then an hour later held a press conference announcing a deal on the USMCA, the new NAFTA trade agreement. Yeah. That was perhaps the strangest moment for me, was that split screen of we're going to remove this president from office or try to, you know, we're going to pass, you know, his signature, you know, what will probably be his signature legislative accomplishment next to tax reform.
Right? I mean, there's a lot of issues with the Democratic Party, but everyone was unified behind it.
There were some Democrats who were basically saying, you know, we are handing Trump a huge political victory on his signature issue trade the day after the lowest moment of his presidency. Why are we doing this? You know, what I actually asked Kevin McCarthy this yesterday, the House Minority Leader, Republican, basically saying, you know, does this show what Democrats were trying to, I think, indicate with the timeline in some ways here was what they often say, which is we can do both these things at the same time. We can hold the president accountable and we can also legislate. We can work together on bipartisan agreements. You know, I asked him about that, and he basically more or less accused the Democrats of intentionally setting it up hide impeachment, you know, to be like, oh, like, you know, they intentionally put USMCA as the last vote of the year. Obviously, the Republicans have wanted to vote on USMCA a year ago.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been wanting to push this for a long time. It was ready in the summer. And, you know, Democrats were actually working to fix certain elements of the deal in terms of enforcement and labor. But the Republicans definitely saw this as a political maneuver to try to shield Democrats from the political vulnerabilities of impeachment.
And that kind of goes to like one of my final questions here, Emma. When we look at 2020 and how we see this vote, this impeachment vote playing out on the not only the, you know, the presidential campaign trail, but in districts in South Carolina, obviously Joe Cunningham's district. But like, I'm wondering how leadership sees this. You know, I was telling you about how, you know, Clyburn said, you know, we might lose some people at risk. This is a tough vote. It was worth it for them, right? I mean, they're saying this vote was necessary. We needed to do this. We might lose some people, but, you know, what's the overall feeling, I guess, for their approach to what might happen in 2020?
You know, I think that it's a long time away.
Mm-hmm. A lot happens
when we talk about 2020, you know, we talk about, you know, more than 11 months from now, mm-hmm. On election day in November 2020, where House members go back for re-election, some senators, you know, Senate races that could determine the majority of the Senate. And then, of course, you know, the balance of power in the White House. You know, no, time will tell. In many ways, this was a political risk. Mm-hmm. For Democrats, because no one knows how this is going to play out. No one knows what the president is going to do or not do, you know, between now and Election Day, and how the public is going to respond to that. And I think that the Senate trial and how that process plays out and how Democrats and Republicans are able to message around it will also be pivotal in determining how this resonates with voters, you know. And then I think another thing, you know, to keep in mind in terms of how Democrats are reflecting on this week, Nancy Pelosi was very resistant towards moving forward with impeachment. You know, and a lot of people have accused her of caving to, you know, the socialist squad and the left extremists of her caucus. And, you know, on the one hand, that's a convenient Republican talking point and a way to spin this for your side of the aisle. On the other hand, Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House, but she is also the leader of House Democrats. And at a certain point, Pelosi had to listen to the overwhelming sentiment within her caucus. And, you know, to say that she caved would have been extreme, but she certainly was responding to the overwhelming desires of her membership. And, you know, that's part of her job, too. And there is a political risk in that as well.
Jimmy, keep with that vein, but yeah. Also talk about South Carolina 2020 primary for right. The Democrats, too, and those that will be in the Senate, of course.
Yeah, well, that could throw an interesting wrench in things. That would be an interesting element of that question, too, of whether or not she sends it over. If she doesn't send it over, that means that
Bernie
February,
Sanders,
I mean, and Elizabeth yeah, Warren and Cory Booker and all those folks don't have to leave the campaign trail, which would be – I don't really know how to interpret that. But the
– she can send it over in March after Super Tuesday.
Right. Yeah, that would be interesting.
You heard it here first, guys.
Must credit. You know, the first district –
she's definitely listening to this podcast.
I've asked all the political – all the presidential candidates what their favorite podcast is, and apparently none of them listen to podcasts.
Wow.
Though Kamala Harris like to pretend that mine
turn
was,
on the SC lead. Yeah. You know, on the first district, I just wanted to say that, you know, something I was trying to ask, you know, both Democratic and Republican strategists this week after Joe Cunningham made up his mind was, is this really going to actually move folks, or is it going to intensify the support and opposition that was already there? Mm-hmm. Because Republicans were sending out polling that they had done in these districts that said, oh, you know, 50% of voters are now less likely to vote for these folks. But those numbers almost directly line up with what the generic ballot already was in those districts, as in the folks that were already going to vote against Joe Cunningham now are, like, really going to vote against Joe Cunningham. Yeah. And the folks that were going to support him are now really going to support him. The question is it going to move folks in the middle? What I will say is it doesn't take many. So even if, you know, he won by 1%. Yeah. You know, so if he loses 1% of folks in the middle over this, mm-hmm. You know, that will hurt. Wesley Donahue, I was talking to, is working for Nancy Mace's campaign or advising Nancy Mace's campaign, one of Joe Cunningham's Republican challengers. Mm-hmm. You know, he was making an interesting sort of argument that he could foresee coming through, which is this idea that regardless what you think about the allegations that the economy has been strong under Trump, people care about the economy, and if you impeach him, remove him from office, that could be at risk. And that's sort of the argument they're going to make in terms of trying to convert this to a kitchen table pocketbook issue as opposed to just a Washington circus political issue. And it'll be interesting to see if people buy that.
And you know, you're talking about the division that already exists in the first congressional district. And, you know, when we look at the division of the country, you know, countrywide, it's there. It's been there for a while. It's 55, you know, 45. It's all those things. But I'm wondering, you know, it doesn't seem like much has changed since that vote. I mean, at least, you know, the nation's still standing. The Congress is still standing. Nothing got torched. But it's going to be interesting, again, to see how this plays out on the 2020 campaign trail. And I'm guessing that's the big takeaway from this, Emma, as we go forward, looking how this maybe emboldens Donald Trump, President Trump, and how Democrats use it to their advantage or if it becomes to their disadvantage.
Yeah, I will say just in terms of, you know, the concept of, you know, nothing's changed, I think you're right at this point. You know, like the country's still standing. You know, the Capitol hasn't burned to the ground.
We signed a $1.4 trillion thing, but we're not having a shutdown.
But one thing, and you know, but one thing I will say is, you know, on the subject of, you know, sort of watching these events unfold on Capitol Hill over the past several weeks, the Judiciary Committee markup, where they considered the articles of impeachment, was some of the ugliest I've seen in terms of political partisanship in Congress. Then the anger and the nastiness and the rage between members across the aisle, it was not political posturing. It was not manufactured. You know, I don't think that we could get any more, you know, fractured politically as we are right now as a country. But certainly Congress right now and the House of Representatives did not leave on good terms with each other. Mm-hmm. There are bad feelings here, and that actually could have an effect on what Congress is able to even accomplish in the next in the next several months leading up to Election Day, especially as the stakes get higher for the political parties in terms of who gets control of the White House next year.
Gotcha. Good wrap up there, right there, Emma. Did you guys have any more parting thoughts or any words on this week, this historic week?
I mean,
in our
important point. You know, I asked Cunningham that actually towards the end of our interview. He's someone who came to Washington hoping to work on a bipartisan basis.
Yeah.
And I asked him, you know, is that actually going to be possible anymore? Is this going to make that hard? You know, his counter was, look, we literally are passing USMCA the day after this.
Yeah.
But again, that took many, many, many months. And the idea that that is, if you ask Republicans, the idea that the USMCA process is a good example of Congress working well is laughable. That was a bad example of Congress working very slowly.
Well, especially because Republicans decided to cave to a lot of Democratic demands in order to get the votes.
And on the spending bill, too. You know, I mean, it's like, I don't know that Republicans are going to be as willing going into next year to do those kind of concessions or Democrats in the same way.
Gotcha. Well, I'm going to say that brings our little podcast here to the end.
It's so fun.
I know. We could keep going, but I don't know if everyone wants to keep listening.
We need another round.
Yes. I know we do. We
need another Jameson on the rocks here.
Emma Dumain with McClatchy, thank you for being here. An old colleague from our Post and Courier days.
This was such a true honor. Truly.
And it's been great seeing you around the Capitol this week.
Yeah, I'll miss you guys.
Yeah, we'll have to come back. We'll definitely be up more in 2020 once we get out of the campaign trail, once the legislature gets out of session.
Senate trial.
Yeah.
There you go.
We might be up here for that. Jamie, always good to see you. Great to see you up here in Washington. And thank everyone for listening. We wish we had more of our lead guests up here from the South Carolina Press Corps. Mayan is up here representing. So everyone back home.
Fresh off her museum trip.
we'll be there soon. And we'll have you all on in the new year, including you, Andy Brown, who's talking trash on Twitter about the lead. We'll just let it slide. My phone just went to sleep and I need to do my outro. But thank you guys very much.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thank you, Gavin. Yay!
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier in McClatchy, D.C. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced at TuneIn in Washington, D.C. on December 20th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays. We'll see you in the new year.